So I'm just going to tell you, in a chronological sort of order, the history of the building, right from its beginnings, and something about the people who live there. So, the first thing you want to know is, when was Eshton Hall built? Well, I don't know. We know when this building was built, we'll come on to that later. But when was a hall or a house built on that site? Nobody knows. But we know that the name Eshton is of Anglo-Saxon origin. It means the farmstead by the ash trees. So there's obviously a farmstead or something here before the conquest. And in the Domesday Book, Eshton is mentioned as being belonging to the Norman Lord of Lancaster, Roger of Poitou. But then it soon passed to the Cliffords of Skipton Castle. And, the Romuald family of Skipton Castle. But the first people to live there were the De Eshton family. So if we have a look at the De Eshton family tree, I think, and I've no real evidence for saying this, but I think that Eshton was probably built for Anice, who was the daughter of William LeGros and Cicely de Romuald of Skipton. William LeGros had two daughters, Hawise, the pointer, and Amice. And I think that Eshton was built for her when she got married. Whitaker, in the History of Craven, says that we don't know the name of this first De Eshton that Amice married. But I've discovered in the archives of the Yorkshire Archaeological Society, an Amice, who in 1200 was a widow, and her husband had been John De Eshton, and he originally had come from Nottinghamshire. So I think that it's more than likely that he was called John. And Amice had a son, who we think was called, well, we think that Galfrid was her son. Galfrid became abbot of Sawley Abbey in 1186, and abbot of Fountains Abbey later. And we know he was born in Eshton, and there mustn't have been much in Eshton at that time, so he must have been of quite high birth. So I think all the evidence points to the fact that Eshton was built for Amice when she got married, probably around about 1150. So that's my own theory. I don't have to go away and say, look, we know when Eshton Hall was first built, you know. But I think that's quite likely. Then we get a series of members of the De Eshton family that we know very little about, and we don't really know the dates until we get to John De Eshton in 1278. We know about him because when Hawise's line died out, Aveline died with having no children. She was only 15, been married 6 years, and she had no children. John De Eshton claimed the earldom of Albemarle from Edward I, who had claimed it. He was unsuccessful. Probably because Amice, they said, may have been illegitimate. She might have been the daughter of a nun by William LeGros. So, I mean, that would have made the headlines of Newsnight, wouldn't it? You know, John De Eshton was there at the end of the 1200s, before he died. And this is the first mention we get of Eshton House, or a building at Eshton. Because apparently there was a local villain called Graindorge, and he used to get up to all sorts of minor things. He used to chop down trees, go trespassing. And William Wheater, who wrote about mansions in Yorkshire, writes that after one of these exploits, Graindorge was pursued by the officer Lawrence Dunnar and his companions to the house of John De Eshton, where he found refuge. The officers, finding themselves baffled there, set fire to Eshton House, and so smoked Graindorge out. They took him to Pontefract Castle and held him in prison there. So that is the first mention that we have about a house on that site. But as I say, I think one had been there for about 150 years before that. I'm pretty sure it had. There were then some more De Eshtons, and the last we hear about was called William in 1391, who was married in a marriage, who was mentioned in a marriage charter. And the very last reference to the Destin family, we hear about four of them in 1415, when we hear about William, John, Christopher, and another John. Now, what happened in 1415? Anybody? Where is the historian? 1415 was the Battle of Agincourt. When this William, this Eshton contingent fought under the banner of John, the Lord Clifford of Skipton. William and John were mounted with armour, and Christopher and the other John were archers. But there's no reference to any De Eshton family member after 1415. So, what do we think might have happened to them? At Agincourt, I think they probably didn't survive. They were the unlucky few of the English soldiers who probably didn't survive. Because the next person that we hear about living at Eshton was in 1450, a Henry de Preston. We know nothing about him, but he's mentioned in a boundary award between Eshton and Flasby. And the next person who was in charge of Eshton was Thomas Martin. He was called Lord of Eshton, and he provided a bow and a horse at the Battle of 1513, Flodden Field. Well done. Good. It's getting better. And then, about 40 years after this, round about the 1550s, Eshton was sold to the Cliffords of Skipton Castle. Now, this is George Clifford, the 3rd Earl of Cumberland. He was probably sold to his father, Henry, the 2nd Earl of Cumberland, but he soon came into possession of it. He was born at Broom Castle, up near Penrith, in 1558, and his father died when he was 11, and so he succeeded to all his father's estates. And being 11, he was placed in the care of the Earl of Bedford. The Earl of Bedford sent him to Battle Abbey, where he was taught the ways and manners of a scholar and an English gentleman, and then on to Oxford and Cambridge. But then, I think the Earl of Bedford could see what a good catch he was, because he took him away from Oxford and married him to his daughter, Lady Margaret Russell. She was 17 and he was 19. And so that's how his life really began. We don't know much about what he did around on his northern estates, because he had quite a few, but we know a lot about him at the court, Queen Elizabeth's court in London. He soon became champion jouster, and here you can see a picture of him when he was the champion of at all tiltings, and he kept that until the day he died. And this is some of his armour. He was good at all sports. You could say he was the sort of the David Beckham of his day, or the Wayne Rooney of his day, but only up to a point, because he was very clever as well. His daughter, Lady Anne Clifford, wrote that her father never attained to any great perfection in the Latin tongue, yet he had a general knowledge and insight into all the arts, especially the mathematics, wherein he took great delight, and was so well versed in the same that it was thought to be the one principal cause of his applying himself afterwards to the sea and to navigation, especially towards the West Indies and those new found lands, wherein he became the most knowing and eminent man of a lord in his time. So, George Clifford financed 12 voyages. This is what he mainly remembered for. He financed 12 voyages to different parts of the world, and they were all pretty unsuccessful. But they did get him much favour at court. He became one of Queen Elizabeth's favourites. And after one voyage, he was having an audience with the Queen, and she dropped her glove. And Clifford bent down and picked it up. And on his knee, he presented it back to his sovereign. But she told him to keep it. And he was so proud that he had it attached to his hat. And forever after, on special occasions, he would wear Queen Elizabeth's glove in his hat. And so he kept going on all these nautical adventures, and by 1590, They were really at their peak. He used to hire his fleet, but he had no vessel to protect it. The obvious thing to do was to hire one from the Queen, or borrow one from the Queen. But that had many disadvantages. It would give the Queen influence over his actions, and she had ordered a no-boarding policy from one of her ships. She didn't want them damaged by fire or by grappling irons or anything like that. So, we're told, in some manuscripts that was found in Skipton Castle, written by Richard Robinson, that Lord Cumberland built a great new ship of his own at Deptford Strand of 900 tons, which the Queen's Majesty herself launched and named the Malice Scourge, or Scourge of Malice. And that's an actual engraving of his ship. But as I've said, most of these voyages were not successful. He never made any money out of them, and he has no reason to be remembered, except you can argue that there was one event in 1600 with which he should be remembered for. And I would argue that this one event made him, perhaps, the one person responsible, the one named person you could point to for Britain building its large empire, the biggest empire the world has ever seen. Because he was the only named person in the charter that Queen Elizabeth granted to the East India Company. The charter was awarded to George, Earl of Cumberland, and 215 knights, aldermen and merchants into one body politic and corporate by the name of the Governor and Company of Merchants Trading to the East Indies. So I think he can be remembered for that. He was dead within 5 years. Didn't profit him much. But now you're asking, what has all this got to do with Eshton? You know, it's supposed to be a talk on Eshton Hall, and we're talking about George exploring voyage on the West Indies. But the fact is that all these adventures were paid for by his estates. And his daughter later wrote that his continual building of ships and in his many sea voyages gave great occasion to this vast expense of his. That which did contribute the more to the wasting of his estate was the extreme love to horse races, tilting, bowling matches and shooting, and all such expensive sports. So it was his estates that paid for all of these voyages. And he had many estates. He got estates up in Cumberland, Westmorland. He had the main ones at Broome Castle, where he was born, and Appleby. But all up the Eden Valley, he got many estates. He got estates in East Yorkshire. Not as many, but quite a few. And then also, most of his estates and his most profitable estates were in Craven. The main ones, at Skipton Castle, Bolton Abbey, Barden, but also he had Eshton, Flasby, Gargrave, Malham, all the way up to Buckden, and he had quite a lot. And if you look at the values of all these estates, all the estates he had in Cumberland, in Craven, in East Yorkshire, the most valuable was Skipton. £416, 8 shillings and eightpence a year, it brought in 1597. Second was Bolton Abbey, brought in £356, 13 and sevenpence. But the third in value of all the estates he had was the Eshton estate, £114, 12 and fivepence. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that you up at Malham, where can I find Malham? Somewhere there, Malham and Malham Moor. £1.16 and threepence halfpenny. So Malham did contribute a lot. Flasby, £7. Gargrave, £72. But it was Eshton that brought in a lot of his money. And to pay for his voyages, he mortgaged these estates. He wouldn't mortgage Skipton, because that's where his main seat was, or Bolton Abbey, but he certainly mortgaged Eshton. In 1587, he mortgaged Eshton for £1,200 for 2 years, then 5 years later, for another voyage, He mortgaged it again, along with Fasby and Gargrave, for £4,600 for 8 months. But by 1598, he wanted to go on another make-or-break trip to the West Indies. And so he mortgaged Eshton again. And this time, he mortgaged Eshton with Nether Heselden, which was up in the Dales, to a cloth merchant called Robert Binloss for £2,000. And in it was a clause that said, if the capital was not repaid within 5 years, then the purchase should be absolute. So he mortgaged Eshton to Robert Binloss, and off he went to the West Indies, and it was like all the others. He didn't make a profit. He lost his money. And by 1600, he said to the Queen, with an audience, a speech of the Queen, that he had thrown his land into the sea, and he later wrote in the same year that he'd spent £100,000 on sea voyages. And that was in those days, that must have been absolute, but was an absolute fortune then. And that he would soon be dispatched to the country, where he would end his days in toil and tears. And they came much quicker than imagined, because within 5 years he took ill at Oxford, was sent to London, and he died at the Savoy in 1605, aged 47. And his servants escorted his body to Yorkshire, and he was buried in Skipton Church on the 29th of December. And Whittaker writes in the History of Craven, "I doubt whether such an assemblage of noble bearings can be found on the tomb of any other Englishman." So the estate passed to Robert Binloss. They held the estate from 1598 up till 1646. We know that they were living there in 1598 because the daughter of Robert Binloss was married from Eshton to a man from Bank Newton. And a later Robert Binloss inherited it when the first Robert died. And he must have been quite a character, because he was MP for Lancaster in 1640, aged only 16 years old. And he was knighted the following year by Charles I. And it was that Robert Binloss, so Sir Robert Binloss by now, that Sir Robert Binloss, who sold Eshton Hall to a fellow cloth merchant, Matthew Wilson. And they probably knew each other through the cloth trade. Binloss exported wool from Kendal down to Southampton and then into Northern Europe, and he probably met Matthew Wilson in the same trade. So Matthew Wilson became the owner of Eshton, and the deed that at that time that sort of was in the sale, talks of the property that Matthew Wilson got. Two messuages, two dwelling houses, a water mill, four gardens, 40 acres of pasture, 6 acres of wood, 100 acres of heath and furze, 20 acres of moor, and 20 shillings in rent at Eshton and Nether Heselden, all for £2,600. And so Matthew Wilson became sort of the master of Eshton. He was, as I say, a cloth merchant, also from Cumberland, and he had great success at Blackwell Hall in London. And it's thought that he probably came to Eshton to escape the Civil War, which was just ending. So he moved into Eshton in 1648. And the house then is described like this. It was Eshton House at this time. It had a central hall, a great parlour with an adjacent closet, a buttery, a kitchen, a brew house, and a garden house. There was a master chamber, two chambers over the hall, three chambers over the kitchen, and two over the buttery. So it would be sort of a reasonably sized manor house, probably at this time. He didn't live long, didn't poor Matthew Wilson. I think he was unhealthy. He had trouble with bronchitis and things like that, and he died in London in 1656, unmarried. And the Eshton estate was left to John Wilson. Now, if you look at the family tree, you think John Wilson must be his son, but he was unmarried. And so the question is, who was John Wilson? Now, I know this would be difficult to read, but Matthew had... Oh, press the wrong one, Trevor. Go back. Matthew had three sisters, and he had lots of surviving nephews and nieces, and yet he left Eshton Hall to his godson, John Wilson. And in the bequest, Matthew left it to his godson in consideration of the love and affection he bore towards John. But I think we get a clue in the next sentence that says, to ensure that the estate would continue in the name and blood of Wilson. I think it was his own son. Because at the time of the bequest, John was lodging with a man called John Nash in Richmond, aged 5. And when Matthew died, he went to live with Agnes and John Backhouse, Matthew's sister. But what is also intriguing is that Matthew had a very great friend and business partner, Thomas Hammond, who married one of Matthew's sisters. He had some relatives, yet he also lived in London, bought Keshfield Manor, probably to escape the Civil War, or be with his chum. When he died, he left Keshfield to the same John Wilson. And it makes me wonder why. I think if anyone could write a wonderful story, you know, a la Downton Abbey or something like that, there's a lot of intrigue there. You could really get a nice story there. I think that John Wilson was probably Matthew's son, real son. And we can see that in the family tree. We've got Matthew Wilson, the first one, who bought Eshton Hall from Binloss, his godson. And then he married Dorothy to John. And every Wilson after that, to this day, has had the name Matthew. All spelled, with one T and not two T's. So they don't get confused. Historians call them Matthew 1. They don't call that Matthew 1. This is Matthew 1, Matthew 2, Matthew 3, and so on. The first two Matthews, we don't know much about. The second one married Margaret Wigglesworth. The third Matthew Wilson is quite interesting because he married Frances Clive, the sister of Clive of India. And she in turn, Clive of India in turn married Margaret Maskelyne, who was the sister of the Astronomer Royal. And the two families, the Clive family lived in Shropshire, they would obviously visit each other. And it seems that this Margaret Maskelyne, the wife of Clive of India, was something of an amateur painter, artist. And when she was obviously visiting Eshton, visiting her relatives, she painted the first picture of Eshton that we have. And this is the picture she painted. This... On the frame, we don't really know the date. On the frame, it says Eshton 1750. On the back, written in handwriting, it says Eshton, painted by Mrs. Clive, 1797. I think it must be earlier than that, for reasons I'll come on to later. I think this is nearer 1750 or 1760, where Eshton at this time is just Eshton at this time is a largish manor house. But what is it? The two things of interest here. That's these buildings down here, down by the river. This picture is taken from the bridge just outside Flasby on the Hetton Road. These buildings, I'm sure, this one here, must be the water corn mill that is mentioned in many deeds, but we never knew where it was. And this one next to it is probably a barn associated with the corn mill, or perhaps a carriage house. But that's interesting, because I think it pinpoints where the corn mill was. And also of interest, if you look carefully, you can see a walled garden behind Eshton Hall. Now, drawing a map to try to show what this was like, we can't see whether the road came this way. The road on the picture seems to curve around and then come down through the field somewhere. But Eshton Hall was here, the walled garden and the watercourse mill and the barn or carriage house down by the river. And I think that it was probably down here somewhere, on this flat piece here. And if you walk up here in the fields now and look at the river, you can see that this part does seem to have been cut away. Whether this was the actual site of the water mill, I don't know. You'd have to do some excavations to see if there are any foundations there. But it was somewhere, certainly, around there. Anyway, by 1800, Eshton Hall had been quite largely defended from the picture we've just seen by Mrs. Clive. It had been extended, or possibly rebuilt. And this is the next picture we have of Eshton. This is from Whittaker. Looks as though the corn mill, which is down here behind the trees, may still have been in operation. They're cutting the corn here in the fields. Unfortunately, this picture's not dated, but I've put it about 1800. With all the other evidence, I put it about 1800. If we enlarge it, you can see that behind, the walled garden is still there, with some sort of greenhouse there. The walled garden is still there, and these are this side are the servants' quarters. What's particularly interesting here, if you just have a look, this side of the house, there are just three windows there. Now, if we look at the next picture, which is also from Whittaker, this, again, it's not dated, but it's got five windows. And this must be before 1825, when we know about the major rebuilding. So I put this around 1820. The archives do talk about lots of building work going on without being very specific about what was happening. But I think this was about 1820. And the walled garden seems to have disappeared. There's no evidence of it there. So this was just before the major rebuilding in 1825 that built the hall that we know today. And I think the reason that all this building work was going on was that because the estate was becoming increasingly wealthy. And the reason it was becoming increasingly wealthy, we have to look again at the family tree. Because the Matthew Wilson III, who married Frances Clive, they had a daughter, Margaret Clive Wilson. And she married the rector of Thornton, Henry Richardson. Henry Richardson was the heir to Dr. Richardson at Byerley Hall at Bradford. And as soon as he got married and inherited Byerley Hall, he changed his name to Curra because his uncle John died and left him Kilbrick Hall. And poor Henry, as soon as he inherited Byerley Hall and Kilbrick Hall, he died. And his daughter was born the year afterwards. So when she was born, Frances Mary Richardson Curra, she was extremely wealthy. Bradford especially, the estate in Bradford, Bradford was developing because of the Industrial Revolution. And it was getting very wealthy. And a lot of coal and iron on estate lands, which they were mined. So there was a lot of money there. Margaret, after Henry died, later married her first cousin, Matthew Wilson. So the whole of the three estates were combined. And so they obviously decided that they would want a far grander building than that rather plain Georgian mansion that we've just seen. So they asked Francis Webster of Kendal to come and produce a plan to rebuild the house. The black lines are all the walls that he didn't touch in his first rebuilding. These are all the servants' quarters and the rooms underneath them, the kitchen and the scullery. These were the rooms that he decided that needed a big change. Before these plans were actually built, they were changed, because the staircase sort of was built in the middle, looking towards the entrance, and bay windows were put here. And the whole of the look of the place was changed from Grecian to Gothic. And so the building started in 1825, and it was built with really high quality ashlar stone, which came from Kildwick Hall, the quarries at Farnhill. It was brought along the canal to here, Raybridge Stave, where a crane was put up by the side, and the stone taken out of the barges, put onto a horse and cart, taken up to Eshton, and then there John and Thomas Midgley were the chief masons in charge that built the hall. And they built it to very, very high standards. You can see this stonework is of really first-class quality. This one stone here, overlooking over the porch, is just one stone of 2 tons. And the whole of the building was extremely high quality, as was the interior, was the same standard. This is the main staircase, solid oak. Mr. Thompson of Skipton turned all these banisters. He charged 1 8 pence for each banister. And Mr. Summersgill put it all together. And the fireplaces, all the fireplaces, the 5 main ones, solid marble from the marble works. This one was in the drawing room, white Italian marble. This cost £160. Don't know what it would cost today. Sorry, thanks.
Yes, fine.
And the whole exterior was completed by July 1827. And this is what Eshton looked like in 1827. Very similar to today, except there is no tower, and the servants' quarters along here still haven't been built. And there's also no wall, no ha-ha surrounding the front of the house. But for some reason, Francis Richardson Currer, who was providing all the money for these changes, and Matthew Wilson, were not satisfied with this. They wanted something grander. And so George Webster was asked to come back. His father had died. George Webster came back and asked to draw up new plans. This was within 5 years, asked to draw up new plans. And these were the plans he drew. Ignore the day, because it was before then. I can't find his plan, but it was like this. This was the house that he'd already changed, and now he knocked down the old servants' quarters, the kitchen, the scullery and the brew house that were over the yard, and he built all these new servants' quarters, and so the house became more or less as it is today. And it was all completed in about 1840. This is the tower. The tower was built in 1839. And you can see, when we were at school, we were told that this was the... all right, done it again. We were told that this was the oldest part of the house because of the stonework. And this was much newer. This looks much newer. But of course, this is older than this is. It's just not the same quality stone. The stables were built in 1840. The gardener's house was built around about the same time, up by the walled garden. And the walled garden itself, over 3.5 acres, was built by bricklayers that came from Blackburn. And you may remember the old bridge going across the road outside Eshton Hall that was the footpath up to the walled garden up in Gambers Wood there. It was interesting because it had a boiler house at one end, and you could send warm air round the inside of the walls so that you could grow peaches and things like that. And then send them down to the hall. The road that you're all very familiar with, this is not the original layout of the road. The road used to come up here between these trees. But Matthew Wilson thought it would be grander if it sort of swept into the main gates, rather than go past on as though you're going to Malham. And so he had the road changed. And you can see that from John Greenwood's map of 1838. This is what it was like. You can see that the building work was going on. The stables were being built. There was no road yet up to the stables. That was sort of being constructed. Interesting that the main garden for the hall was down by the river. accessed by a sort of circular walk. And the walled garden up in Gambers Wood was just being built. The road itself was going straight past the hall. This was the line of trees. And you can see that a year later, in 1839, the road is still going past straight, hadn't been changed. The walled garden had been built, although the gardener's house was still here, opposite the old barn, which is still there today as the barn, so that gives you some idea of where the gardener's house was. And the dog kennels would also move up to here. But the stables had been finished, the road down to the hall had been finished, and that was in about 1840. So the whole of the estate was completed by 1843. This is a picture in 1870, but it remained unchanged until about the year 2000. Well, it's still the same from the outside, but it remained unchanged till about the year 2000. And the person mainly responsible for all these changes was this lady, Mary Richardson Keller, because she inherited all the wealth of those three estates I've told you about. And she never married. She was slightly deaf, and so she absorbed herself in her books. And she inherited Dr. Richardson's library from Byley Hall. And because of her wealth, she was able to expand that library. It was already a substantial library, but she made it bigger. And she could get any book, any first edition that she wanted. And when Dr. Dibdin visited Eshton in 1836, he wrote about her being the head of all the female book collectors in Europe. And it certainly was, almost certainly, the largest private library in England at this time. Estimates vary, anything between 30,000 and 70,000 books. And at one stage, they went into every room in the house. The most prized ones were here in the library, where Matthew Wilson and Richard Kerry had special bookshelves built. This is where the prize books would be kept. And also in the drawing room, the same bookshelves holding the most prized volumes. Now, the question that I know some of you want answering is, did this lady ever visit Eshton Hall? Charlotte Bronte. Some people think she did. She used as her pseudonym the word Caramel, when she wrote Jane Eyre. And in Jane Eyre, there's a man called Mr. Eshton. So she certainly knew about Francis Kerr, Richard Kerr, and the library at Eshton Hall. But did she ever go there? Did she ever visit? Now, my headmaster asked that question to Matthew Wilson in the 1950s. And Matthew Wilson said that they had found no correspondence between the Wilsons and the Brontes. But absolutely there wasn't any. I have found none in the day books of Matthew Wilson. Matthew Wilson wrote all the important visits to the house in the day books. But I haven't looked in the day books of the later 1840s when she probably visited. No one else has, as Trevor will say, because it's full of papers that have, you can see, have never been blotting paper. It's never been used for 150 years. So they could have been there, but they do take a long time to go through. And I haven't looked at them all. So if she did visit, they might be in there. But she certainly knew, Charlotte Bronte certainly knew Richardson Currer and the Eshton Library, at least by reputation. She probably met her at Cowan Bridge, the clergy daughter school that Francis Currer supported. And she might have met her at Stone Gap in Lothersdale, where Charlotte Bronte worked as a governess. So I leave it to you. If you like to think she visited Eshton, she may have done, but there is no evidence yet. She died in 1861, did Francis Kerr, and she hoped that the library would be a sort of be kept at Eshton as a heirloom, but it was not to be. Matthew Five, who's in charge by this time, sold the library the year after she died, sold part of the library, and it was sold at Sotheby's. There's only a small part of it, and it took 10 days to sell just part of the library. And so Matthew Wilson Fyfe became became the owner of Exeter when Francis Currer died. Mm. He was already a widower. He had married a girl called Sophie, and she had died in rather tragic circumstances when she was only 29 years old in 1933. Sorry, in 1833. She would have been a lot older than 29 in 1833. In 1833. And after she died of kill recall, Sir Francis came to live with his father, who was still alive at this time, and Richardson Currer at Eshton Hall. And for the first few years after she died, he didn't marry. He adopted the life of a country gent. He went hunting, coursing, shooting, but he was gradually drawn into politics and became MP for Clitheroe twice, and then MP for the Northern Division of the West Riding, and that's why his statue is now in Skipton, outside the library in Skipton Town Hall, and he was made a baronet in 1874. He didn't marry until 1878, when he met a widow in Brighton called Frances Pedler, and because he used to go and spend the winters there, his health probably wasn't too good in his later life, and he died there in 1891. And Sir Matthew Wharton Wilson, who was very popular, lived in Gloucester. When he inherited Eshton, he came to live here. He was master of the foxhounds in Gloucester, but he wasn't very interested in politics. In fact, in any kind of politics, he just lived the life of a country gentleman, and Eshton became the venue for the local hunt. And he did open the grounds to the public. He got on very well with his tenants, but he died in 1909, was buried at Gargrave, and succeeded by his son, Amcott. Amcott took more of an interest in local affairs, still not going to politics, but he was more interested, also very well liked, but continued the country pursuits and the hunt. You know, the Craven Harriers at Eshton Hall, the hunt continued to be held at Eshton. He died in 1914, and that saw the start of the decline of Eshton Hall, along with many other, we know, large houses and estates. But one of the main reasons was this man. He was succeeded by Sir Matthew's son, Matthew Richard Henry Wilson, who had married the daughter of Baron Ribblesdale, Barbara Lister, and he had a very distinguished army career, but I'm afraid his private life was not so distinguished, because he was called Scatters, which describes what happened to money and investments and property that he got his hands on. It just went through them. He gambled. And he was not interested in living at Eshton. He immediately said he preferred to live in London, much more exciting place to live. Well, there are lots of reports about him living in London, written by sort of independent people who call him a dashing soldier from Yorkshire. He was a great entertainer. Everyone loved him, and he had a very great number of high-profile affairs. But he also gambled, and he had to start selling off parts of the estate. There was a sale in 1914, he sold part of the library again in 1916, and he sold most of Gargrave at a major sale in 1919. And he died in 1958, and Matthew Martin Wilson, his son, succeeded to the title, but he wasn't married. He was homosexual. He didn't marry, and it was he who sold Eshton out of the Wilson family in 1959. He died in 1991, and Matthew Tony Wilson took over. He lives in the United States, but he came over, he visited Eshton 3 years ago to commemorate the centenary of Amcott's death, and he laid a wreath in Skipton. But the decline, as I've said, had already started in 1914. The estate was at its height in the few years before that, when Amcots was there, the end of Wharton's and the beginning of Amcots's sort of tenure. This is Eshenhall around 1910, when it was at its height. And it was around this time that Queen Mary, the consort of George V, decided that she would break her journey north to Balmoral and come and stay at Eshton. This is the bedroom that she slept in, this one. This is a very great honour. And so Amcots Wilson and his family got all the local gentry, and they decided that they would have a large meal in the dining room, everything ready, all in their best. And they all got there waiting for Queen Mary to arrive, and she was duly picked up at the station, brought up to Eshton Hall, and Amcots met her at the door. And before he could speak, she said, "I'll take 2 lightly boiled eggs in my room," and swept past, up the staircase, into the bedroom, and no one saw her again. And she left the next morning, just like that, a great disappointment to all those who were there. And then came the outbreak of the war, and Scatters started selling off some of the estate fixtures and fittings, the carriage, the horses, the motor car was sold. Scatters himself in the First World War went to serve in Egypt. He re-enlisted, went to serve in Egypt. So Eshton was let for the first time. And it was let to a girls' school from Scarborough. This is a picture of a postcard that one of the girls sent to one of her friends. Scarborough was thought to be on the front line of any invasion from Germany. Or bombing or shelling from ships, and so the Western school moved there for the war. After the war, it moved back, and Scatters returned from Monte Carlo, Egypt, then Monte Carlo, then England, more broke than ever, and that's when he sold most of the Eshton estate. The major portion of the village of Gargrave, Knowles House, Bridge Home, Greenhead, the Stainton Coates estate, He sold all of that. And in the 1920s, Eshton was let again, this time to Arthur Stanley Wills, who was a director of W.D. and H.O. Wills Tobacco of Bristol. He had married someone called Hilda Dewhurst, who was born at Airville Hall in Skipton, so she obviously wanted to come back. So they leased Eshton Hall, and they opened up the grounds, especially to all the school children, especially to come and see the snowdrops along the woodland path in the spring, which is still there to this day. Is that right, Trevor? They still can see them to this day. Arthur Stanley Wills died in 1935, and his wife left soon after that, and Eshton Hall was empty again until the war. But then it was let again, and this time to another school from Scarborough, no connection with the previous school. This is a top prep school called Bramcote, and they also feared invasion or bombing, and they came to live here during the war. And many, many of the children have written, these boys have written, to say what a wonderful time they had at Eshton. They all speak very, very fondly of their stay, especially the buildings and the surroundings. And one of them, a boy called Ralph Rumley, who wrote in a book called The Consul, part of the book, he says, "The school had been evacuated from Scarborough to a place called Eshton Hall, not far from Skipton. It was very beautiful. We stayed in a mansion, a real palace, a very elegant edifice built in the early 19th century. There was a river, woods, abandoned gardens, orangeries. I loved hunting for birds' nests, or for tickling trout for the stream. Particularly for trout in the stream, and there were badgers and otters. And lots of boys seemed to enjoy their stay here. The younger boys played cricket on the lawn at the side. If they wanted a proper match against some of the older children, they used to have to go and use the cricket field at Gargrave. But the winters during the war were pretty bad. And a lot of the boys used to, they couldn't play out properly, so they used to have to play in the library. This is the old library with the bookshelves. It was still full of many of the books that Richard Sakura had bought, and Matthew Wilson wanted them boarding up when the school took over. But the headmaster said that he wasn't running a reformatory, you know, he wouldn't have anything to do with it. But the boys used to play football in here. They used to put goalposts at each end, tie handkerchiefs into balls and kick them about, trying to score goals. But they always ended up on top of the bookshelves until they had no handkerchiefs left. And so they used to send the youngest boys up to climb up them and get them. But many of them had fallen down the back. But Christopher Seale has summed up the stay of the people at Bramcote. And he writes in the book I've written, he wrote to me and said that it was, and I hope still is, a treasure of a place. To have lived there for most of 4 years during the war was an indelible and happy memory, whatever little monsters we undoubtedly were. And so after the war, Bramcote moved back to Scarborough, but Eshton was opened almost immediately as a school. It would remain a school for the next 20 years, till 1966, mainly under two headmasters. Mr. Purdy was a teacher at Bentham. He opened the school, and it was a mixed school in those days, and they were there for 8 years, and then it was taken over by Mr. and Mrs. Rowan Robinson. And his first thing he did was to phase out the girls, make it a boys-only school. But it didn't last. The school closed suddenly in 1966 when Mr. Baldwin was headmaster. He'd just been headmaster for a year, and then the school had suddenly to close. It became a nursing home almost straight away. It changed hands in 1987. You notice the swimming pool. I don't think many of the residents must have used it. They changed it into a fish pond shortly after that. Mr. Brosnan took over, but the upkeep was very, very difficult, and it closed in 2002. This was after the nursing home closed. This was the old library. This didn't seem in such bad condition when some of us went to look around it, but the deterioration was evident in other places. This was the marble hall above the dining room, and there were buckets on the floor because you can see that water just poured in whenever it rained. The roof was in a very, very bad state of repair. And so it was sold to the Dare Group, and then passed on to Burley Property Developments, and they rebuilt Eshton Hall. Then we had taken off all the roof and replacing it. A lot of the buildings round the back were knocked down and replaced by more modern buildings. The staircase itself was actually sagging. When you went in, you could see it actually sagging, and it had to be shorn up and repaired. And the library, and I wonder when they had to replace all these bookshelves. But I wonder, you can see some of them taken off to be replaced, how many handkerchiefs they found in there. I bet they could have opened a store or skipped a market and sold them. So it's converted into luxury apartments, and this is what Eshton is like today. That's on the outside, and on the inside we can see one of the upstairs apartments. This is the old library. Notice that the bookshelves have all been covered up, or most of them have been covered up, and in the drawing room. They weren't allowed to take them out. English Heritage said they had to stay where they were, so they had to be just covered up. And this is the library now when it's been occupied. And so, that's it. So what have we learnt? We think Eshton was built around 1150, or I think it was built around 1150, for Amice, the daughter of William LeGros. Then we have the story of George Clifford, who, quite a remarkable character, but he lost it through his extravagant ways. It then went to Robert Bidloss, and then Matthew Wilson, fellow cloth merchant. We're not certain still who John Wilson was, but I think he was his son. And then there was the major rebuilding when the present building was built, 1825 to 1840, paid for by Francis Richardson Currer. And then the start of the decline, which wasn't helped by Scatters. It was let to a ladies' school. In 1919, there was a major sale of parts of the estate, and the hall was let, first of all, to the Wills family, then Brancoat and Esham School. And in 1959, it was sold by the Wilson family. And they had nothing more to do with it. And it became a nursing home, and then it was converted into apartments. That's Eshton. I hope you've learned a little bit. And so when you come past Eshton, you'll know a little bit more about it. Thank you.